Good evening, and thank you for tuning into Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we invite a special guest from the KC Food Circle, Mrs. Emily Akins. We will discuss the upcoming local food expo. We'll also hear from the Lawrence Public Library about their seed library. And as always, we'll round out the hour with a calendar of local environmental events you may want to be a part of. But first, I'm Natural Lee with your environmental news. The LATimes.com reports, a common pollutant in vehicle exhaust, power plant emissions, and cigarette smoke can shrink white matter in the fetal brains and cause developmental damage during the toddler years, a new study suggests. In 40 children examined by researchers, prenatal exposure to polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons was correlated with reduced white matter on the left side of children's brains during their early childhood. Those physical changes in the brain's internal wiring were also correlated with slower cognitive processing and with symptoms of attention deficit and hyperactivity, according to the study published Wednesday in the journal JAMA Psychiatry. Quote, they tend to be fidgety and hyperactive and very impulsive, so they leap before they look, end quote, said Dr. Bradley Peterson, director of the Institute for the Developing Mind at Children's Hospital Los Angeles and the lead author of the report. The researchers had previously tied behavioral and cognitive problems to 8 common types of these pollutants, which are a product of incomplete combustion of organic materials. The new study now suggests those problems have a biological root in the altered architecture of the brain. Numerous studies have linked air pollution, especially particulate matter, to respiratory and cardiac problems. But over the last decade, researchers have accumulated more evidence that particles and other types of airborne pollution can affect brain development. MidtownKCPost.com reports, the mission of the Giving Grove, an operation of Kansas City Community Gardens, is to provide food for the needy. As it starts its third year, the group has planted 754 trees that will produce more than 200,000 pounds of fruit annually, says Ryman, the Giving Grove executive director. The Giving Grove concept started with church activists who fed the homeless but wanted to do more. On April 1st, they will start planting 170 other spring trees. People who want more information or to apply for trees can do so at the group's website. EcoWatch.com reports, a couple weeks ago, Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell said that the new regulations for fracking on federal lands from the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, would be released within a few days following a 4-year process that included receiving more than 1.5 million public comments. On March 20th, she unveiled those new rules, which take effect in up to 90 days. The BLM claimed that they would, quote, support safe and responsible hydraulic fracturing on public and American Indian lands, end quote. Drilling has been occurring on federal lands for years, with more than 100,000 wells in existence. However, following the fracking boom of the last 2 decades, more than 90% of the new drilling operations involved that process, evading the regulations of 30 years ago. Rather than the ban on new drilling that many environmental and citizen groups sought, the rules focus on safety issues like well construction and chemical management and disclosure. And TheGuardian.com reports, studies of the costs of reducing carbon emissions compared to the overall costs for adapting to climate disruption, such as net agricultural productivity loss, human health effects, property damages from sea level rise, and changes in ecosystem services, have already demonstrated that it's cheaper to stop using fossil fuels. But a new study shows that there are even more costs associated with fossil fuels than the social costs of carbon, quantified by relative dollar amounts. Former NASA scientists Drew Schindel, now a professor of climate sciences at Duke University, went beyond the cost of climate change to account for the costs associated with other air pollutants released during fossil fuel combustion. Schindel estimates that carbon emissions are relatively cheap compared to other fossil fuel air pollutants. For example, sulfur dioxide costs $42,000 per ton, and nitrous oxide $67,000 per ton. Fossil fuels only seem cheap because the market price excludes society's costs from climate damage and personal and ecological health costs. Fossil fuel prices are artificially depressed by massive taxpayer subsidies like public land giveaways, lax safety standards, offshore drilling fee waivers, FEMA cleanup services, etc., and by inflated insurance premiums for climate and pollution-related damage response. And that's my last article for the environmental news this evening, and I would like to welcome Mrs. Akins to the program.
Thank you for having me.
and we are glad to have you. Now, you're with the KC Food Circle.
Mm-hmm.
And what role do you play with the KC Food Circle?
I'm the coordinator.
So what's that mean?
Well, that just means that I work with a group of volunteers. We're all volunteers, and we have a coordinating committee of about 12 people. And together we all work towards connecting eaters in the Kansas City area with the local organic and free-range farmers who are members of our organization.
So how long has the Kansas City Food Circle been around?
It's been around for about 20 years. It started as a project of the Kansas City Greens, started out life as something called the Organic Connection. Mm-hmm. And then in 94, it became the Food Circle. And in 99, they hosted the very first Eat Local and Organic Expo. And we've been having expos every year since then as the movement continues to grow.
So we had an expo last week at mm-hmm. Johnson County Community College, mm-hmm. and we're about to have one this weekend at the Longview.
It's actually next weekend, and it's at Penn Valley.
Okay, excuse me. Wow, yeah.
That's okay.
Thank you. So before we talk about that, though, what are some of the things that you do during the year that aren't this large expo that's annually?
Sure. Well, we do spend a large portion of the year planning the expos. They're pretty big events, and we enjoy getting everything ready for those. But during the growing season, we spend a lot of time just helping people make connections. And people are looking for CSAs to join. CSA is a community-supported agriculture program. It's like a subscription to a farm. We get a lot of inquiries from people who are interested in becoming a member of a farm, and we direct them to our member farmers who have CSA programs. We also promote featured organic farmers markets, and these are markets where all of the vendors at each of these markets adheres to our growing standards. These are the standards that we require all of our member farmers to agree to when they join our organization. So we feature about 8 of these markets. And these markets are easier for folks who are looking for organic. It's easier to shop at those than the larger markets where some of the vendors are organic and some are conventional. But we also have many of our member farmers who sell at a variety of markets. We also have an eater membership program that goes all year long. We invite folks, just general public, anyone who enjoys eating, we invite them to join our organization as a member. Mm-hmm. And that membership lasts the whole year, and it gets the member an Eat Local and Organic dining card, which is a discount card that gets you a 10% discount at 15 area restaurants who are all sourcing their food locally and sustainably. We also, this year, are introducing a number of workshops, classes, farm tours, farm-to-table dinners, some other events that some will be open to the public and some will be for members only. All of these things really serve our goal of connecting people with the farmers who grow the food. So whether it's meeting a farmer at a farmer's market or attending an event where you get to eat some delicious food that came from a local farm, or whether it's an educational piece where we teach folks about eating locally, that's our goal, is to connect the farmers and the eaters.
Okay, and just so our listeners know, April 11th, at 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the Penn Valley Community College is when their next annual event is. And so at this expo, I see on your website you will have local organic produce, mm-hmm. free-range meat and eggs, mm-hmm. and seedlings, so people can take them home and plant mm-hmm. their own organic.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sure you have a variety of things.
Oh, yeah.
And CSA information. So what would someone want to do if they wanted to get a part of a CSA?
CSAs it's a great way to get local food. What we encourage is that folks who are interested peruse our website and search for CSAs, or better yet, come to the expo on April 11th, where
corner.
You'll get to talk to farmers directly. The CSA is really about a relationship between an eater and a farmer. And so we encourage folks to find a farm that has a distribution point near to where they live or work. What that means is many of the farms may grow in a rural area or urban. We've got farms sort of all over the city, but they'll distribute in sort of a central location. So we encourage folks to find a farm that has a distribution point that's close to where they live or work or go to school or go to church. And then they will get to enjoy a weekly supply of vegetables from that farm. Mm-hmm. They pick it up, you know, near their work or school or wherever. And they also get that personal connection with that farmer. So they get to see the farmer or they get to hear from the farmer. I found that farmers often have the best advice for how to prepare something or how to store something. It's also really nice to give people confidence in where their food comes from. Mm-hmm. If you know the person that grows your food, and if you have been to the farm, many of the farms that are members of our organization are happy to have folks come and visit the farm and see the operation, see where it goes. It gives you confidence to know about where your food comes from. I like to tell people that my CSA farmers, I have them programmed into my cell phone. If I need to call them, I can. It's cool. A really important connection. And I also think it gives us a stronger appreciation for where our food comes from, but also for the environment. So I often tell the story that before I joined a CSA, I didn't pay much attention to the weather unless I just needed a raincoat or something. And now I've begun to sense more intimately what's going on in the environment around me and how that affects my food supply.
That's neat.
So it really puts you in touch with the seasons in an important way, puts you in touch with where your food comes from.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like, so the CSA, for the eater, it ensures weekly mm-hmm. Fresh organic food that you know where it came from. And then it also seems like it's also a win for the farmer, so they can ensure that they'll be able to continue to practice their organic farming.
Absolutely. It's a great way for them to get the capital that they need in advance and to know that the work that they're doing has a place to go. So at the beginning of the season, they know they're going to have so many members and they're going to have so many mouths to feed. And then they also get that payment up front. And every farm has a different payment structure, but the majority of them do ask for some payment in the beginning, and they use that to grow. You know, the farmers that sell at market, they go to market and hope to sell what they have. And with the CSA, I think it's a slightly more stable model for farmers to know, if I grow this, I've got these folks who are going to eat it. Mm-hmm. So it's really a win-win for everybody. It's also a way to eat more healthy. I don't think that... that was not at all what I was intending to do when I joined my CSA, but I certainly benefited from having so many whole foods come into my diet mm-hmm. that I hadn't been able to do before.
Now, I know a lot of people who choose to eat organically, and so they go to the little local store we have up here on Main mm-hmm. or some driveway out to Whole Foods, but I know that Whole Foods also does sell GMOs and conventionally grown things, and it's a large corporation, so like with the CSA, you know where it's coming from, you know it's organic, and you are you're supporting the farmer. I just think that's really important because it's one step, you know, local mm-hmm. is as important as mm-hmm. organic.
Absolutely.
I like that your expo is local and organic, because both of those are just very important, because I know I've learned about travel time with food. Mm-hmm. You know, even if it is organic, like the travel that I had to go through. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of hidden inputs, I think, that a lot of people don't realize. So when you're buying food that has been trucked in from 1,500 miles, that's the average, they say, you have to think about the resources that go into first growing it, and typically it will come from a farm that, if it's a conventional farm, that has used a lot of pesticides, so there are a great deal of inputs there, chemical and otherwise. And then, of course, the oil it takes to travel that far. Which is all pretty disconcerting, not to mention the fact that they pick it before it's ripe, and then it gets sprayed with who knows what, and then it's ripens on the way. And, you know, I also like to tell people that I used to think I didn't like tomatoes, but that's because I was eating the sort of plasticky ones that had been shipped in from far away.
In the same way.
And once I started eating heirloom tomatoes that were fresh,
life-changer.
You know, when I pick them up, they were still on the vine that morning, and I pick them up that night. And I mean, it's a totally different tomato. Absolutely.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I love that. Yep.
But the local piece is really important. We talk a lot about the local multiplier effect, which is this idea that states that if you spend a dollar at like a national store, mm-hmm. only 15 cents of that gets reinvested locally. But if you spend it at a locally owned independent store, and I would say farmers market too, 45 cents of that gets reinvested locally. Mm-hmm. And so it's an economic boost as well. In addition to feeling more confident about your food, you can feel good about supporting the local economy. And when you're buying directly from the farmer, you are you're contributing more to your local economy, because so much money is staying with the farmer rather than going to, you know, the person that manufactured the box or the person that designed the logo that went on the box or, you know, all of these other processing elements that that are a part of the process economically. So we like to also explain to people how buying your food directly from a farmer, it's good for you. You get fresher, tastier, healthier food. Mm-hmm. It's good for the farmer, mm-hmm. But it's also just good for the Kansas City community.
Mm-hmm. Economically, and then also in the news, we heard about the air pollutants. And just getting less semi trucks off the road would be like a dream to me. And mm-hmm. so less buying from stores is one way to do that. So, I mean, there's all these hidden positive things about buying from a CSA, you know, yeah. that we don't think about. And you don't even have to think about, because if you join a CSA, you know, that the Kansas City Food Circle has information about that on their website, kcfoodcircle.org, then it's just a variety, just a seems like a domino effect of positivity.
Yeah.
And you will also see those positive results. There's all kinds of information out there you can read about eating organic and local versus eating conventional or yeah. just anyone is welcome. The internet is a wonderful tool.
Yeah.
So tell me something else about this expo. We will get information about the CSAs. Mm-hmm. What else will we get there?
Well, it is kind of like a giant farmer's market. So you can kind of expect that the same types of things you'd get at an early spring farmer's market, you'll find at the expo. So this time of year, that would be some herbs, some early spring greens. See, I got some carrots on Saturday, had those for lunch today. And then, of course, the seedlings or transplants to put in your garden. We also have a number of free-range meat farmers, so there's a great deal of meat, eggs, cheese. We have several dairy farmers in our organization. We actually have 108 member farmers this year. That's our record number. We're excellent. Pretty proud of that. A lot of good farmers doing a lot of good stuff around our region. But it's really a full spectrum. And we have some bread vendors as well. You could get sort of everything from for your whole meal at the expo. And there are a few specialty items. I bought a beautiful wooden ladle from one of our member farmers who part of their operation is to create handcrafted wooden utensils. Mm. So there are often a lot of neat surprises. And most of all, you get to meet farmers. That was really the impetus for this event, was how can we bring the farmers out and give folks an opportunity to meet with farmers face to face and to see where their food comes from, to talk to the folks that grow their food. We typically try to provide an educational experience at our expos, and this year we're very excited to present a workshop for kids of all ages. It's called Little Sprouts, The Joy and Wonder of Learning How Things Grow, and that will be taught by Dana McDaniel of Seed Savers KC, and it's really an introduction to seeds, pollination, fruit production, seed harvest. It'll be a hands-on activity that will show kids of any age and parents just the magic of gardening. And all the kids that come will get a little pot and a seed to take home and plant too. So we think it's important to help kids understand where their food comes from and what that process is. And we do find that a lot of the folks who are new to the local food movement are families or new parents who are beginning to think more critically about how their family eats. And I know that was my own personal journey to organic food. It was reading a startling statistic about the levels of pesticides in breast milk that made me think, well, before I was about to have children, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to see if I can start curbing some of that now. And I switched over to a more organic diet. Mm-hmm. But we do see a lot of folks come to us with that in mind.
Mm-hmm. And so some people seek out this type of eating because they want to make that change. But I think that a lot of times some people are afraid to make the change, or they just don't see it as important, you know, because I grew up here too, you know, America in 2015, it is what it is. But I think that a lot of times we think that we're going to have to give this up. If I come to this Eat Local and Organic Expo on April 11th, I'm going to have to be vegan or vegetarian or something. And it has, so, you know, sometimes we can be extreme with our thoughts, and it has nothing to do with that at all. It's like you like tomatoes and cheese and you want to make a grilled cheese. You can still eat a grilled cheese sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
It's just that when we learn about these farmers and things like that and get involved, it's just, I know where my cheese is coming from instead of not knowing where my cheese is. That's all it is. I know where this tomato came from instead of not knowing where this tomato came from. All it is just some knowledge of the trail that it took that food to get to your plate. That's all it is. It's that fear of the unknown, but really, maybe it's the fear of the known. Don't be scared of the know. Come talk to these farmers. Let's say you've never had a fresh fruit in your life, because it's real. Sometimes it's like that. Let's say you've never had some fresh food in your life out there, listeners. I'm sure you have. But this would be a great opportunity to kind of, you know, break that seal and just kind of open that door. You said you have 108 farmers involved. Yeah. So you can just talk to people who have been doing this. Maybe you'll find someone who's new to this and just... I just think this is a great opportunity because you have everything at this expo.
Yeah. So. Yeah, we really do. And it can be, you're absolutely right that it can be intimidating. And we often encourage people not to be discouraged if you come to this saying, gosh, I don't really know how to cook this food. Mm-hmm. You go pick up your CSA share and there's a kohlrabi in it and you look at it and it's shaped like an alien spaceship and you think, oh, dear God, what have I got myself into? But the thing is, any of us, you know, in this country, in this day and age, like you said, we've just been trained to eat food that comes to us in a shelf-stable form, in a box or a bag. Mm-hmm. It has instructions on the side for how to cook it, and it'll wait on the shelf until you're ready to cook it. And if that's how you've learned to cook, then this is a huge shift. Mm-hmm. So what we say to people is, you know, make sort of small goals and ease your way into it. You know, start with one item. Say, okay, I'm only going to get my eggs from local farmers. I'm not going to buy the conventional eggs anymore, and I'm just going to start with eggs. And I think too, you know, if you're already interested in this, the further you get into it, I think the more compelling it is. Also, the more delicious it is. I mean, that was the big factor for me, was this food tastes so good.
It's true.
But you know, start with one thing, or maybe you say, okay, I'm going to go to the expo, and I'm going to get enough to make just one meal, and everything in this one meal is going to be totally local organic. So you try one meal and see how it goes and ease your way into it. You know, as far as joining the CSA, we encourage people to try a smaller share. Most CSA farmers will offer a small share and a large share. We say try the small share, or try it and share it with a friend and see how it goes. And if you're too nervous to join a CSA, you can always shop the farmers markets and just go little by little. And again, getting the chance to talk to the farmer is the best thing. So you pick up the funny looking spaceship kohlrabi at the farmer's market and you say, gosh, what do I do with this? I don't even know. And I have gotten great advice from farmers you know, recipe suggestions. And I think that's the best way to do it. And like I said, you know, ease your way into it and give yourself some grace, knowing that you probably didn't learn how to cook any of this stuff. You know, maybe your grandmother did or your great-grandmother did, because it was the 20s and everyone grew these things. And maybe not kohlrabis, but, you know, in the 20s, everybody grew their own food and canned it, not because it was a movement, but because it was the 1920s. Well, we as a society lost all that, and it's just now coming back pretty strongly. So that's the other thing is, like you said, the internet's a great resource, and there are tons of suggestions and tips and CSA recipes and things like that. A lot of stuff that's available. And we're working towards trying to help people that join our organization, our members. One of the member perks we have this year that's new is to create a forum where the eater members that are part of the food circle can kind of chat with each other and say, here's a recipe I found and what do you do with this and stuff like that. So we invite folks to do that on our Facebook page, or, you know, many people do this at the farmer's market. That's the other beautiful thing about shopping at the market, is it becomes sort of a community event, a social event, rather than just a trip to the store. Although we shouldn't criticize grocery stores entirely, because I've been really impressed over the last few years at how hard some local stores are trying. The one on Main here is doing a great job of sourcing from our local farmers.
Yes, I see it in there.
They do a good job.
Yeah, and I am very appreciative of that too, because wintertime, what can the farmers grow during the winter? Is there?
Yeah, there are some tricks of the trade. We've got several farmers who are using high tunnels or greenhouses, and I was able to buy spinach in the dead of winter. Wow. And we do have one farmer's market, one of our featured organic farmer's markets, that runs 10 months out of the year. It starts the first week of May and goes to the last week of February. So all the way through the winter.
Wish I would have known about that.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible. It's every Friday night. It's Bad Seed. Every Friday night from 4 to 9 during the season and 4 to 8 during the winter. And many of our member farmers sell there. So we had folks that were growing in high tunnels and greenhouses, and you can get quite a few greens. Some of the hardier greens, obviously not the more delicate stuff, but the real hardy greens, you can keep those growing in the winter if you have the right equipment. And I think people, I think the farmers recognize the need for that and are working more towards that. One of our member farmers, so they actually do two things. They grow microgreens. They're city bitty farms. They grow microgreens, but they actually have another business where they're establishing the equipment that you need in order to grow during all four seasons. The name of that program is Four Seasons Tools, I think. So I think people are really seeing a need for that. But also, it was my farmers that encouraged me to start doing some food preservation. So I bought a canner, then I bought an even bigger canner, and I started preserving the harvest so that, you know, in the middle of summer when you have more tomatoes than you know what to do with, process them. In your mason jars in the basement, they'll wait for you, and in the dead of winter, you can crack those open.
That's like that's a whole other level.
It is, and that can be pretty intimidating too. It took me a few years to get to that point. I will confess. So you may not want to jump in all the way, but we've got great resources for that in town too. We've got the extension programs. The K-State extension program was at the expo last weekend, and the MU extension program will be at the expo on April 11th with free information on how to can, how to preserve. Again, it's the stuff that our grandmothers and great grandmothers did. We're just relearning it as a society.
Knowledge is power.
It is.
And food.
Yep.
That's incredible. Okay. So does it cost this expo?
Nope. The admission is free and parking is free. We do suggest that you run by the ATM on your way in so that you have enough cash to buy from the farmers, although we've got some pretty tech-savvy farmers who have their little square things and can take a credit card.
All right, and you do these expos twice, two of them annually.
Yeah, two each spring, one on the Kansas side, one on the Missouri side.
And will there be a seed saving workshop at this event?
Mm-hmm.
And so what's that about?
It's the one for kids, the Seed Savers KC workshop will be for kids. We're saying it's for kids of all ages. Okay. So it's really geared towards kids, but I know that Dana McDaniel, who's very passionate about seed saving in general, she works hard to educate kids and their parents to understand how to save seeds. She's a great resource.
Yeah, so I'm curious, what's the difference between the Johnson County Expo and the Kansas City one, like one right in the heart of the city, one in the suburbs? I can speculate, but maybe I'll just let you answer that.
Sure. We have several farmers that attend both, but we do have some farmers that just choose to attend one or the other depending on their location. And so you kind of get a slightly different mix, although it's a similar array. You definitely can find all the same sorts of things, maybe with a different set of farmers. We have in past had slightly higher attendance at the Johnson County Community College event, but we get a pretty good turnout at Penn Valley too. So we like to host two events, in part because we know not everyone can come to one, but also because we like to have representation on both sides of state line. And so some of our more northern located farms, they might choose not to go so far south into Johnson County. Vice versa, somebody who farms way out south in Kansas might choose to just go to that expo and not the Missouri one. But really, in terms of what we offer to the public, it's pretty similar. Now, if you have a favorite farmer you want to see, you might check and see which expo they're going to be at. But we do list that as well. So if you're looking for a particular farmer, we'll put the list for the Penn Valley Expo up on our Facebook page probably next week.
And the food circle, I assume, has a table there.
Of course.
Yeah. Is that a good opportunity for you to outreach to people and get new people involved?
Absolutely.
Speaking as someone who's tabled at this on behalf of KKFI and Eco Radio, I think it's wonderful the interaction with people, and that's a big difference. You can go to a store and buy some stuff, but it's not a social experience, right? And there's a whole level where it's okay to talk to people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even if you're shy, it's okay.
Yeah.
And quite an interesting thing. And so is there anything we haven't gotten out yet? I know we'll want to mention the website again, but is there anything else that we haven't mentioned at least once yet?
I don't think so. I think we covered it all. The Little Sprouts workshop is at 10 o'clock if you want to come to that. And the expo doors open at 9:30. There will be food trucks on hand. I think we just have one food truck. So come hungry. You can also pick up quite a bit of food that's ready to eat right there at the expo too. Mm-hmm. And any information about our organization too, like you said, we'll have that at our table. We also, in the hopes that we can help educate people and give people the resources they need, we also will have some cookbooks for sale. We have a kids cookbook as well as a just a regular cookbook called Seasonal and Simple. They're great resources for eating locally. So we'll have those available as a fundraiser for our organization. We are, like I said, all volunteer nonprofit. So we support, we welcome any kind of support we can get.
Okay. And one other question to think, do you guys still distribute those directories?
Yes. Thank you for that reminder. Yeah. We do. We have to keep adding pages to the directory. So this year we have our longest directory yet. Like I said, 108 farmers. Actually, I think 106 are in the directory and two joined after the directory went to print. But everyone will be welcome to a free copy of our directory of farmers. Those will be available at the expo, and then we will distribute them all year long at tabling events.
Will the locations of the farmers market be in that directory?
They are.
Okay.
Yep.
Good.
We have a list of farmers, our featured organic farmers markets. We also have a list in that directory of questions to ask at the farmers market in the hopes that we can help people know how to approach shopping at the farmers market to get the information that they need to make an informed decision about what they're buying.
All right. Well, this is really open to everyone in Kansas City, so I mm-hmm. hope that you really feel welcome to just come out and try this. If it's your first time, just come on out and you can come talk to the people at the Food Circle. And if you want to check out their website, it's kcfoodcircle.org. And the event is April 11th, Saturday, 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the Penn Valley Community College.
And that's in the gym, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, thank you so much for coming down and sharing about this. And it's really exciting. I do want to issue this disclaimer that you may catch spring fever if you go to these events.
You will.
So, Emily, thank you so much for coming down.
Sure.
We're going to hear about the Lawrence Seed Library coming up right after these messages. And again, before I do that, the website again is
kcfoodcircle.org.
Great.
All About Water on Counterspin, Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., right after Radioactive Magazine. China's government is making life hard for some religious groups, but it's actively promoting a Buddhist revival.
If you pay the big money, the Buddhas will protect you. Doesn't that make the Buddha also a corrupted official?
I'm Maureen Fiedler, the latest in our God and Government series, next time on Interfaith Voices. Tuesday at noon, right after the mayor's State of the City address.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Global warming can cause record winter storms. It may sound counterintuitive, but it's no snow job. When the oceans warm, more water evaporates into the air.
And what that means is there's more precipitation. Water is cycling more vigorously through the atmosphere, and that gives us more extreme weather.
That's Michael Mann, a professor of meteorology at Penn State University. He says in summer, an unusually warm ocean can strengthen storms like Hurricane Irene. But in winter, the evaporation from a warm ocean collides with cold Arctic air and turns to snow. As seawater evaporates, it also releases additional energy into the atmosphere. This extra energy then fuels storms, making them more intense. This past winter, a large area of the North Atlantic was much warmer than usual, which Mann says contributed to the record nor'easters that buried parts of New England in snow.
So climate change is actually providing more energy to intensify these nor'easters, and it's providing more moisture so that they can convert that moisture into record snowfalls.
2014 was the warmest year on record for the global ocean surface. So New England, get your shovels ready for more extreme snow in coming years. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I have on the phone with me Kristen Soper with the Lawrence Public Library. Welcome to Eco Radio KC, Kristen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I'm very curious. The Lawrence Public Library is trying, to my knowledge, something that hasn't been tried before, probably reinventing the word library to some extent. It's becoming a seed library in addition to books and other media. Is that correct?
Well, seed libraries, there's several libraries around the country that have seed libraries. And actually, the Kansas City Public Library, the Ruiz branch, has a seed library where they collect seeds. They distribute seeds and collect them at the end of the season.
So how does that work? Do people just bring seeds down, or are they vetted, or to verify what they are? Or how does any of that work?
It kind of varies from library to library, and also depending on local agricultural laws. But a traditional seed library, you distribute seeds at the beginning of the season, and then patrons return seeds back to the library. However, we are just dipping our toe in this year, so we are simply distributing seeds and then kind of gauge how the program goes, and we might expand it next year.
So if I were to go into the Lawrence Public Library, would I say, where is your seed section, or is there a separate area for it? Or
yeah, we have an old-fashioned card catalog, and then we'll have our seeds divided up by vegetable, herb, and flower. And beyond that, it'll be in alphabetical order, so you can just go to the card catalog and pick out the seeds that you would like to try to grow in your garden and just take them home and garden with them.
And so I thought I read somewhere that you're dealing with heirloom seeds and non-GMO seeds and...
Yes. Yeah, that's our... we've solicited donations from companies like rareseeds.org, Territorial Seeds, High Mowing, and Botanical Interests are all companies that have generously donated seeds to us. And we've divided some of those up, and we are hoping to focus on the non-GMO, kind of more heirloom style seeds.
Interesting. How did this come about? Was this did this initiate from the library, or did someone bring it to the library, the idea?
Oh, it's been something that's kind of been on our library radar for a while. And we have a partnership with Lawrence Memorial Hospital, and all of this was kind of in conjunction with healthy living and healthy eating. You know, if you can grow your own garden, vegetables in your own garden, that's a really great source of nutrition that's time intensive, but, you know, you can eat well and rather cheaply if you grow your own food. So that was kind of the push that made us have a seed library.
So, okay. So if things go, you know, really well, what do you, like, where do you see the seed library maybe 2 years from now?
Well, we hope to, you know, incorporate test gardens and have volunteer help with those test gardens so that we can test seed viability and make sure that the seeds we get back are, you know, the seeds that we want them to be, that it's, you know, not cross-pollinated or anything like that. So that's kind of how the program is where we would like it to be in a couple of years as we develop it. Mm. But that's traditionally what you have to do to do a seed library, is to test those seeds to make sure that they're actually the seeds you want, and then you repackage and redistribute them.
So this will be a seasonal thing, I guess, or will people be able to check out seeds any time of year, or how does...
It will last as long as our seeds last, mm-hmm. Our seed supply. I expect it'll probably be seasonal, so it'll probably just be in the spring, you know, given our inventory. I anticipate them to go quite quickly. So.
And are there special storage considerations, like a cool, dry place kind of thing, or where you have to keep the seeds? Or?
No, we haven't considered any special storage yet. We're generally working with seeds that are only about a year old, so I think the viability of those seeds would still be good in just kind of room temperature conditions.
And has there been any response from the public yet? Because you really haven't kicked this off, have you?
No, we kick off on Monday. So we've gotten we got a good bastion of volunteers at our local seed fair. So there is interest, but it'll be interesting to see how the community responds to it come next week.
Interesting. And have you taken any steps to get the word out?
We've got it. I believe we have a blog post on our website, but we'll start hitting social media to kind of get the word out. And then just the physical presence of the seed library within the library, I think, will be a good way to get the word out.
And is this just for Lawrence residents, or can people from neighboring communities also participate?
If you have a Lawrence Public Library card, you can come down and get seeds, and we are limiting it to 10 packs per patron. And then we're just asking people to sign out the seeds that they have taken so we can kind of gauge what was popular this year and get the popular seeds next year.
So people who are interested in following up on this can go to the Lawrence Public Library website. What is that?
It is www.lawrencepubliclibrary.org.
Okay, well, that really sounds good. Good luck with this. It sounds like you guys are doing some exciting stuff. And
thank you.
We'd like to touch base with you again and see how things are progressing.
Okay,
that's okay.
Yeah.
All right. Kristen Soper with the Lawrence Public Library, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Hi, this is Mayor Sly James. Please join me at Starlight Theater at 11 o'clock a.m. on Tuesday, March 31, for the annual State of the City Address. Everyone is welcome and there is no charge. But if you can't make it out to Starlight, there's great news. KKFI is broadcasting the speech live as a public service. Learn more about the state of the city at kcmayor.org. I hope to see you at Starlight at 11 o'clock a.m. on March 31, or tune in right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Justly or not, drones have become a provocative symbol of American power, running roughshod over national sovereignty and killing innocents.
Marjorie Cohn on Death by Drones on Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
Recharging groundwater during wet years on this current cast. During the recent drought, California has drawn on groundwater reserves to irrigate crops and make up for less precipitation and snowmelt. Heather Cooley of the Pacific Institute, a nonprofit research group, says California is looking at ways to recharge groundwater during wetter years.
In the simplest version of groundwater recharge, you flood the area and then the water gradually infiltrates, percolates down into the groundwater.
For a faster but more energy-intensive option,
in other areas, they do have injection. So there are pumps that are essentially injecting water underground.
But Cooley says recharging groundwater deep in the earth is challenging, so conservation is the best option. Support for CurrentCast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
All right. I'm going to look now to Kansas Interfaith Power and Light, a group that works with faith organizations, congregations to mitigate climate change in the state of Kansas. And they have an advocacy update published today I'd like to share with you. So as the Kansas State Legislature prepares to recess for nearly a month, here's an update on the various pieces of legislation. The Clean Power Plan, there were two bills that were designed to restrict the KDHE's ability to develop a state implementation plan under the EPA's Clean Power Plan. The first, SB 151 or HB 2233, would have overlaid the KCC's regulatory process over the KDHE's rulemaking. The second, SB 170, was an Americans for Prosperity sponsored effort to further complicate an already complicated process, primarily by requiring legislative approval for any state implementation plan. Both bills passed the Senate Utilities Committee. The utilities, Westar, KCPL, and Empire, negotiated with the legislators on SB 151. What came from that is that the KCC and the KDHE are required to work together to develop the state implementation plan, and they are to report back to the legislative committees for comment. But those committees do not have to approve the plan. Once this was negotiated, we went from opposed to neutral. We don't believe, that's Interfaith Power and Light saying this, we don't believe any legislation was necessary, but this at least doesn't needlessly extend the process or require legislative approval. This version of the bill was passed by the full House last week. And SB 170, according to Interfaith Power and Light, the worst bill, is still waiting action on the Senate floor. At this stage, we don't know if there will be any. Also, you may have heard that Senator Mitch McConnell wrote to all 50 governors encouraging them to ignore the CPP and not develop a state implementation plan. As far as we know, Governor Brownback has not commented. And then on renewable portfolio standards, as you know, this is the third year that bills to repeal the renewable portfolio standards have been introduced. Hearings were held on both bills, HB 2373 and SB 253, but no further action has yet been taken. An added factor this year has been the introduction of taxes on wind energy, one capping the property tax exemption on wind turbines at 10 years, and the other introducing a 4.33% excise tax on commercial sales of renewables. And that's HB 2401. There's no bill in the Senate at this time. Our understanding, and again, that's Interfaith Power and Light's understanding, is that the wind industry is willing to accept the property tax bill as long as it's prospective on new construction and not retroactive on facilities already in use, i.e. property tax on 10-year-old facilities could start tomorrow. The excise tax, however, is another story. Wind developers have power purchase agreements to provide power for a fixed price for 20 or 25 years. And you can find out more about this at kansasipl.org.
And thank you so much, Mike. I'd like to invite Emily Akins back to the mic. She's here with the KC Food Circle.
Thank you.
And the event is coming up at the, what is it? Where is it happening?
The Eat Local Organic Expo is at the Penn Valley Community College Gym on April 11th from 9:30 to 2:30.
And we've talked a lot about what the Food Circle offers. And really, you're about connecting the eaters and the farmers.
That's right.
And you do that a number of ways. We talked about the CSAs. Mm-hmm. And
We have a variety of ways we do that. We offer information in our directories that we hand out at the expos. We invite folks to shop at the farmers market, especially our featured organic farmers markets, and just get to know the farmers who grow their food. We also like to support the other entities that are supporting our farmers. And so we do have some, definitely some grocery stores around town, but also some restaurants, about 15 restaurants this year that are participating in our Eat Local and Organic Dining Card program, which grants our eater members a one-time 10% discount at each of these restaurants. It's a really nice way to support the restaurants who are supporting our farmers, mm-hmm. and then also to support the general public, the folks who support us financially with their membership dues. It's a nice way to say thank you to them.
Well, thanks for the community that the Kansas City Food Circle is bringing together between the restaurants, the eaters, and the farmers. And I'll see you April 11th.
Sounds good.
And I'm Naturally, and I have your local environmental events for the week. First, the Environmental Law Society is joined by the Kansas Rural Center and the Kansas Farmers Union in hosting a lecture by Professor Stoll at the Casey Ecumenical Building at the corner of 12th and Jayhawk Boulevard. This takes place Thursday, April 16th at 7:30 p.m. Groups from around Missouri, including 350 KC, are in the process of forming a Missouri Clean Energy Coalition to push for the adoption of a strong Missouri energy plan to go beyond compliance with the EPA's Clean Power Plan. The bulk of the groups involved in this effort are based in the St. Louis area, but 350 KC wants to be sure that the western side of Missouri is represented when the MCEC takes stage at the Take Back Earth Day lobby and rally on Wednesday, April 22nd, at the state capitol in Jefferson City. To accomplish that, we need as many of our supporters there as possible. Please let John know if you would like to join them on the trip by emailing him at 350kclead@gmail.com, 350kclead@gmail.com. And the Lee Summit Journal posted, if you have trees, love trees, or hope to have trees in the future, you may want to take advantage of an interesting opportunity to hear tree experts and ask questions. You are invited to a tree seminar sponsored by the Lee's Summit Tree Board, a function of the city's Beautification Commission, and it starts in 10 minutes at 7 p.m. today at the Gamber Community Center, which is located at 4th Southeast Independence Avenue. So if you're in Lee Summit, perhaps you'd like to head on over. You can bring your questions and they'll be willing to give advice regarding selection and care of young trees, how to determine the right tree for your property and how to plant it, what to do about the emerald ash borers, and how to properly mulch and feed your trees. And also there will be door prizes. Electric car charging for workplaces. Is electric charging right for your company? Hosted by the Greater KC Chamber of Commerce, USGBC Central Plains, Electrify Heartland Coalition, and Kansas City Regional Clean Cities, this event will showcase the opportunities, benefits, and considerations of offering electric charging to employees. The event will be held Wednesday, April 1st at Greater KC Chamber Boardroom, Union Station, 30 West Pershing Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Registration and networking begins at 7 a.m. The program will be held 8 to 9:30 a.m. For more information and to RSVP, visit the event page they have created, and I posted a link to that on our Eco Radio Facebook page. The State of Renewable Energy in the Midwest is hosted by the Heartland Renewable Energy Society. Are we on track for a new energy future? What should we expect for the future of renewable energy? Five panelists will cover the state of solar photovoltaics, wind energy and fracking, legislation impacting renewable energy, utilities in the renewable energy age, and energy efficiency retrofits. An open discussion between the panel and the audience will continue as time allows. This free event will be held April 4th from 2 to 4:30 p.m. at 8700 Shawnee Mission Parkway in Merriam, Kansas. RSVP at info@heartlandrenewable.org, or you can visit them on the web at heartlandrenewable.org for more information. And thank you.
Is California's water literally going to pot? That and other stories for the week ending March 29th, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
On Saturday, March 28th, 2015, there were 11 earthquakes in the continental United States measuring more than 2.5 on the Richter scale. Eight of those were in Oklahoma, and in the past week, the state experienced about 50.
Many Oklahomans are concerned that the quake activity in the state has been caused by oil drillers injecting wastewater into the ground. The injection wells could be lubricating fault lines leading to the quakes.
Last week, it was learned that officials in Oklahoma have issued new regulations requiring well operators to prove they aren't injecting water into the layer of rock where geologic faults lie. If they cannot do so, they will have to take action to insulate the injected water from the layer of granite.
A spokesperson for the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, which regulates oil and gas, told State Impact that statistically, the more earthquakes you have, with an increase in magnitude, the greater your chance for a major quake. and he implied that a major quake could occur at any time.
The Hanford Nuclear Reservation in eastern Washington state was part of the Manhattan Project during World War II and produced material for the bomb that dropped on Nagasaki. Subsequently, it has been used to produce material for the nation's nuclear arsenal.
Hanford is also home to a nuclear power plant that stores radioactive spent fuel. The soil and groundwater at Hanford is contaminated with nuclear waste, and some of that polluted groundwater is already entering the Columbia River.
Most of the radioactive pollution that now gets into the Columbia is quickly diluted in the huge river, but environmentalists warn that contaminated groundwater plumes are growing.
The Daily Beast is reporting that there are now concerns that one natural disaster, such as an earthquake, flood, or fire, could have major effects on Washington's agricultural industry.
Washington is the second largest producer of wine in the country and the third largest exporter of fruits and vegetables. About 160 wineries are within a 60-mile radius of Hanford, not to mention the 250,000 people who live in the nearby Tri-Cities area.
Meanwhile, the Obama administration's budget for the next year proposes spending cuts for cleanup along the Columbia River by almost $204 million, down to $108 million. Washington Senator Patty Murray told the Tri-City Herald that she fears the Department of Energy is trying to pull the plug on cleanup efforts.
A recent study highlights the effects of marijuana cultivation on water in Northern California. Until now, the impacts of pot growing there have not been documented.
But now a study by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife concludes that the demand for water to grow pot, along with the current drought, are having a lethal, if not damaging, effect on endangered salmon and steelhead trout.
The report notes that a pot plant requires about 6 gallons of water per day, and the demand exceeds the stream flow in some areas. The lead author of the study told RT News that all of the streams with large-scale marijuana cultivation went dry.
Efforts are now underway to compel pot growers to obtain permits for water diversion and discharge.
Meanwhile, many other Californians are turning over every rock to find sources of water, from recycling to desalination to tapping prehistoric aquifers. So it might shock you to learn that bottled water companies such as Nestle continue to pull water out of streams and aquifers.
But as the drought worsens, their water draws have become the target of activists. A group gathered recently at a Sacramento bottling facility to protest Nestle's virtually unlimited use of water while local residents have had to cope with increased restrictions.
The coalition, known as the Crunch Nestle Alliance, claims the company is draining up to 80 million gallons of water a year and paying a residential rate for the privilege.
The group is demanding that Nestle either pay rates that are commensurate with their profits or shut down production until the drought ends.
And that's not the only place in California bottled water is getting scrutiny. Earlier this month, Ian James of the Desert Sun published an extensive investigation of the industry and found that no state agency is tracking exactly how much water is used by all of the bottled water plants in California, nor monitoring the effects on water supplies and ecosystems statewide.
And speaking of bottled beverages, finally this week, according to the latest data published by Beverage Digest, Americans are buying less soda pop.
Sales of soft drinks in the United States have plummeted over the past 5 years, according to the market research firm Euromonitor. That includes both regular and diet soda.
So what's driving this trend? Two things. Americans are reaching instead for energy drinks, fortified water, bottled or tap water.
The second, and possibly more significant reason, the numerous headlines claiming that diet soda causes accumulation of belly fat and an increased risk of strokes, heart attacks, and diabetes.
Add to that a growing mistrust of artificial sweeteners such as aspartame, and diet soda sales are going flat.
The American Beverage Association, which represents Coke, Pepsi, and others, has responded by funding studies showing the benefits of the diet drinks,
which they hope will put the fizz back in soda pop. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.